Hey, listeners, before we get started with today's episode, I wanted to let you know about some fun changes we've made to our Undeceptions Plus subscriptions this year. We've added a bit more for the Keeny Beanies. We've planned a few extra singles episodes just for Plus subscribers that we'll scatter across the year. We've already dropped one of them, so there's that waiting for you. We're also planning a few live podcast events in Australia and the US in the next year. And Plus subscribers get first option on tickets, and they get a discount. You'll be the first to know. And we've added a new level of support. So if you're a diehard fan of the show, you might like to check that out. It'll get you all the existing benefits, plus a personalized message from me, which producer Kaylee tells me people actually want. And you'll get messages from the team and the opportunity to participate in a few Undeceptions recording sessions, like what's going on here right now. You'll literally be online with me and the team as I record my lines. It'll be embarrassing for me, but maybe some fun for the team and for you. As always, we are grateful for your support of the podcast. It's an expensive show to run, and we're always looking for ways to make it bigger and better. Your Undeceptions Plus subscription allows us to do just that. So head to undeceptions.com/plus to become a subscriber today. Okay, on with the show. Undeceptions Podcast.
I come out of this this sex program. They recommend a period of celibacy when you start out in recovery with the sex stuff, because it's supposed to kind of reprogram your brain somehow. So I decided I'm gonna go for a whole year.
What do they recommend?
I still don't even remember why I kept going after a full year, but I went 461 days. And they don't recommend anything like it's very case by case. You know, there's not one, you know, thing that they recommend for everybody. But for me, it was recommended that I'd be celibate, I think, for a year.
Wow.
I went for a year and 3 months. Which at the end of the day, I think, was like just sort of sexual anorexia. You know, I don't know that there's anything healthy about that approach in hindsight.
That's entertainer and comedian Stephen Glover, aka Steve-O, of the hit TV show Jackass. Oh, I even said that with an American accent. Speaking there about his experience in rehab. Steve-O has a long documented history of substance abuse, but he's also opened up recently about his past struggles with sex addiction, for which he eventually sought treatment. One of the recommendations for Steve was celibacy, which didn't go down too well. Surely that's the opposite of being sex positive, which we're all meant to be nowadays. I mean, it is literally sex negative. Celibacy is a controversial topic. On the one hand, periods of self-imposed celibacy are increasingly seen as healthy, and we're going to put a link in the show notes for you to see what I mean. On the other hand, celibacy, even the traditional celibacy of no sex before marriage, is sometimes seen as repressive. And again, see the show notes. Researcher Al has been very busy on this topic. The Bible is pretty clear that sex is a gift of the Creator to be enjoyed only in the context of a permanent union of a man and a woman, what we used to call marriage. The logic used to be clear to most cultures, even the pagan ones. Given that sex is A, pleasurable, B, binds a couple together emotionally, and C, perhaps most obviously, creates babies, sex is only for the human relationship where all three of these purposes cohere, the enduring bond of a man to a woman. Now, I know there are plenty of people who dispute that that's even what the Bible teaches, These are mainly the warm-hearted theologians. But the analytic historian in me just can't make the historical text say anything other than what it says. The Bible might be wrong on this topic, and tons of people think that. But you can't change the meaning of ancient words in their ancient context. So, what do people do if they agree with those ancient words and yet find themselves same-sex attracted? There's quite a few people like this. Some of them are really good friends of mine. Often, this group calls itself Side B. Now, you might not have even known about Side A, but Side A is basically just the group that affirms same-sex relationships in all their forms. So Side B pursues a life of celibacy while still admitting to being same-sex attracted. People in Side B know that they have always felt attracted to people of the same sex, just as I've always known that I'm attracted to people of the opposite sex. This doesn't mean that folks generally lust for people of the same sex, any more than my heterosexuality means that I generally lust for women. It's just that they're aware that their enduring disposition finds people of the same sex more attractive than people of the opposite sex. But because they believe the Bible, they seek to redirect that natural disposition in ways that they feel are pleasing to their Creator. Why am I telling you this? My friend, Dr. David Bennett, has a remarkable story. David was a gay man happily going about his life when, at 19 years of age, a very unexpected thing happened. In a pub on Oxford Street, Sydney, one of the central hubs of the gay community, he was suddenly confronted with the love of God. David became a Christian and eventually made the huge decision to pursue a life of celibacy. He now works at the University of Oxford as a postdoctoral research fellow in the Faculty of Theology and Religion. He specializes, among other things, in, ready for it, queer theology and, ready for it, holy virginity. I would never have imagined we'd end up with an Undeceptions episode titled Holy Virginity. I just feel like saying it over and over. David isn't what you'd call a progressive Christian. He is firmly Side B. It's even in his ex bio. But his reflections on queerness and the queerness of celibacy are compelling. I caught up with him in his home in Oxford and we had a wonderful conversation. Here's just part of it. Plus subscribers may eventually get the whole thing.
Well, the way I came to value God, I think really came in with the issue or problem or question of desire. Because, you know, surrounded by the secular world that was very about desire, get your desires fulfilled, do what your, you know, what where your desires lead you is your true personhood. You know, you're gay, therefore, you know, this is this huge part of your identity that will define your life, get ready for it. And I think as I, you know, went down that rabbit hole of desire, I kind of hit up against what I call ultimate reality, or, and I think we all have these experiences as human beings where someone—
Is this sort of university age?
Yeah, university age, about 19 years of age. And I remember writing the question, what is love, in a journal with a Charlie Chaplin pen on Oxford Street in a like club, kind of Oxford Art Factory. And I wrote like, what is love? And handed out to the group, you know, the kind of party scene there. And a lot of the people there were like political leaders, intellectual leaders. And so I thought, well, I might get an interesting answer. And I didn't, all the answers were like really, really, really underwhelming. And even less than underwhelming kind of broke me into a crisis. So that whole kind of secular ideal of love and erotics just broke for me. And I was like, there has to be more to life. I remember saying to myself, I'm going to be single or celibate for a year. I'm just going to give it a break and stop looking for this, like, untouched, like this thing I couldn't quite touch, which was called love, that wasn't really fitting with my romantic experiences, my friendships, you know, just generally, I like didn't really know what love was. And so I think it was the question, I wasn't really looking for God, but I was looking for love. It just happened to be the fact God is love. And that's what I ended up discovering in a pub in the same quarter of Sydney, you know, months on from that experience.
What, some Christian opened their mouth and it made sense, or something else?
A Christian who's quite eccentric, who's a filmmaker, and actually Baz Luhrmann was their mentor and they were at university. And I call this person Madeline in my book. And she told me that basically God had inspired her career to be a filmmaker for disabled people. And I was very, I found that very compelling because I had a disabled uncle, and also being queer or gay, there's a strong overlap there in terms of the existential realities of those things. And so I was just compelled by her, and I trusted her because of that work. And I saw something different about the fact she wasn't just into the artifice of film, she was actually into this kind of social prophetic messaging about inclusion, which is super important to me as a kind of pretentious gay activist at the time, you know, a precocious gay activist at the time, being 19, you're not really a gay activist, I suppose. But yeah, that really touched me. And then she prayed for me and I had a powerful encounter with God in those prayers that kind of totally flipped my life 180. So I kind of came out of the pub with a Christian heart and an atheist gay activist mind. And so the journey from there to now has really been, how do those two things come together?
Indeed. You've not just committed your life to Christ, to celibacy. You've gone and studied holy virginity in the ancient church. We are whacked. Before we get to that, can you set the scene for us in sort of ancient patterns of thought? Between what you've called stoical repression and the kind of libertine expressionism that were both options and everything in between in the Roman world. What do you mean by stoical repression?
Well, I think I'll come to an experience I had recently. I was at Christ Church College and Tom Holland came, you know, he's written the book Dominion about his own journey of looking at the ancient world and the kind of erotic cultures, ethical cultures that were, you know, made up the Roman world. And what I found fascinating about his inquiry into that was that he realized very quickly that he was actually ethically Christian, and that there was this kind of libertine expressionism. You know, I just have my desires as I want them, I get power, you know, I build this patria. That means I can have this culture of free expression that is limitless. And you see this in the Roman emperors, you see this in the kind of cults of the emperor. There's this kind
and
of...
And all the HBO series
HBO
about Rome.
Series about Rome. But then you have this other side of it, which is a very strong classical idea of the stoical tradition, which is trying to perfect the self through your own inner powers, you know, and through nature. And, you know, being celibate might be seen as something you could do to show off that virtue of self-perfection.
And it's negation, isn't it?
Yeah.
It isn't the redirecting of love.
It's the self, absolutely.
And of passion and eros. And
desire. And so you have, in modern scholarship, Martha Nussbaum has talked a lot about this problem and sees Christianity very much as almost like a stoical religion.
Yeah,
you know, that needs to be.
Martha Nussbaum is a celebrated American philosopher and author with a particular interest in Greek and Roman thought. She's spoken extensively about Stoicism and explored its similarities and differences with Christianity. In particular, she notes that Christians saw emotions or passions as good things within reason. Stoics, on the other hand, saw them as things to be overcome.
Yeah. You know, this is what I wanted to ask you about, because as people hear you talking about the stoical repression, people are going to go, oh yeah, that's just Christianity.
Absolutely.
Right? So there was a tradition in Christianity that was like that.
I think there's always been an inflection. The church can't live in a cultural vacuum. It's always going to be, affected by what's around it. Mm. So even, I've studied Augustine, and you see inflections of all the different philosophies of the time in his work. But really what Augustine is doing is subverting those philosophies.
We'll get to him in a second,
love.
For sure.
So yeah. Christian view of love. And actually, a loving self-giving, or the word, fancy word we use, is asceticism, but really this self-giving of Christianity, where you give yourself either in marriage or celibacy, is about a much more profound and beautiful, enchanting reality than just showing your virtue, trying to perfect yourself repressively, or expressing a self without any boundary line for morality or for goodness. So I think Christianity provides this third way through that problem that our culture is built on in some way. And I love how Tom Holland has just found that innately in himself and not necessarily claiming to be a believer. So I think we need to trace the origins of our own desire culture and our own morality, and we will hit up against what I hit up against in that club, that really Christianity provides the best theology of desire, best philosophy of love. I think that's what I found in my research.
Mm. What's the analogy you see between holy virginity and your personal commitment to gay celibacy?
I think the kind of holy virginity that Augustine describes, I think it's important here that I'm not saying all holy virginity of the time, because there were forms of holy virginity that betray this, but holy virginity that's coming out of that motivation of being like Jesus and witnessing to this culture of a different way, a different form of love, for me, that's a highly strange and odd thing in Rome. It doesn't fit. And so I think similarly, not just a gay celibate Christian that's saying, well, I have to obey this moral code, otherwise people won't like me and the evangelical world won't like me, so I better do this or I won't be included. And so I'll repress myself and live a miserable existence on the side while whatever, that kind of like self-repressive picture, but rather a kind of, I'm gonna use this word, erotic celibacy, like that holy virgin I'm talking about in Rome, who loves God. It's coming out of a love-based motivation, a grace-oriented motivation. That kind of gay celibacy, I think, is a highly queer thing in a similar way to how the holy virgin was truly Christian at the time was queer. So I think there's this overlap. Mm. And it's also, we're in two moments of crisis. Like, there's a crisis over gay marriage. There was a crisis over virginity in a very similar way. It's tearing the church apart. So it seems at the base of crises like these, there seems to be these queer subjectivities, like the gay celibate Christian or the holy virgin. So I think that's how I see the overlap. Mm.
You just put your finger on what is a central theme of your research and the message you want to get across. So I want to just pause on it and get you to put it in more words. And that is that it isn't for you about denial per se, it's about the redirecting of love.
That's right.
So it is, it's not passion repressed, but passion directed.
Yeah, a figure that's been really, has inspired this for me, well, obviously it's the whole patristic world. I mean, I was obsessed with this idea. So, but a modern theologian, Sarah Coakley, has written about this in her book, New Asceticism, where really she says a healthy asceticism is never a total denial of something, like the dualism we were talking about, the body's bad, the spirit's good, or whatever. But it's this rechanneling of desire towards another goal. And it's a healthy meeting of that desire, recognizing that desire itself was originally a gift. It's not originally a curse.
Mm. It's quite profound. You also say that your approach, now in the personal, present, actually testifies to the good of marriage.
Yes.
And some people are going to go, like when I first read that sentence, I was going, oh yeah, how's he going to pull this off? And you did. So how on earth are you testifying to the goodness of marriage?
I think that marriage without celibacy falls apart, and celibacy without marriage falls apart. So they're actually codependent, or interdependence, probably a better word. There's this interdependence between the two. So I like to think about Christians, or human life actually, just generally, as a pilgrimage. It's not a static existence. We're always dynamically moving towards something, and desire is part of that movement. You can never stop desiring, otherwise you're dead. And even if you try to stop desiring, then you end up repressing yourself and it comes out some other way, you know. So for me, marriage is the created order, you know, being represented in humanity in sexual difference. And celibacy, at least of the kind I'm talking about, is trying to witness to that good by being excluded from it, which is really quite a...
Yeah, because you're not pursuing the desire that is open to you,
yeah,
as a gay man. You're not walking that path. And so that's the idea. And therefore, you're pointing back to this other thing.
That's it. So it's actually an exclusion for the sake of a more radical inclusion in the transformation of the created good. So it's both upholding the vindication of the created good of marriage, whilst also being excluded from it for the sake of its transformation, being included in its transformation. And I don't think we've really understood that in the Christian ethic. And then for people who aren't Christians to understand, Christians aren't there trying to beat themselves up over the self-flagellate. They're living for a greater vision. Yeah,
I can imagine someone listening to our conversation now and going, come on, David, you've just found this nerdy Oxford Augustinian rationalization for the tragedy of suppressing your romantic sexual urges.
Well, I look at Jesus and how he loved us, and Jesus gave up all of his desires, his whole created, you know, future, like the goodness of it, to save us. So for me to participate in that aspect of his life through my sexuality, that's me just expressing my Christian faith. It's me being like Jesus, and it's not me repressing myself or thinking being gay is necessarily this horrible dualistic curse, you know. I think what's really interesting about this is being gay has become a gift that has linked me to Jesus even more profoundly, because he was excluded from the created good in order to witness, in order to give us access to its radical transformation in the resurrection. So I'm in a way moving in the ways of Jesus with my own desires through this asceticism. It's not a rationalization, it's just a reality, you know, that I live. And it's a really beautiful life, but it's queer. It can't be seen easily. It's something that's covered over by normative discourses. It's something that progressive conservative doesn't want to see, because it's radically threatening to those certainties.
It's interesting you use that word queer. You've used it quite a bit. So let's drill down on that.
Great.
You see your model. Yeah. Well, firstly, let me ask two questions, and you answer them how you like. But first, wind back and tell us the significance of queer theory, and then why you would dare to say that your gay celibate path is a queerness, if not an extreme queerness.
So what I see in the Bible is the character of the eunuch, and this is something that, this might be a weird place to take the conversation, but we're talking about queerness, so it should be weird. In the Bible, there's this idea of this person called the eunuch. We don't quite know what a eunuch is. It's not a stable entity. Like, it could be sexual minorities of all kinds. You know, gender ambiguity, something like being transgender today or being gay. It could just be that physically you can't procreate, that this kind of category of the eunuch. And scripture basically likens Jesus to a eunuch. When in Isaiah 53, it says, you know, where is his generation? Who has heard of his generation? It means, where are his kids? Where's his family? Like, he hasn't sexually reproduced. And paradoxically, through the cross and resurrection, he actually reproduces. He actually has children. There's this idea of kind of fecundity. It's not sexual, but it's become spiritual. And that's queer. that's strange, that's odd. That's not how a Jewish worldview or a Roman worldview would ever think of procreation, fecundity, self, like fruition of the self, you know, self-actualization today. Like all of that philosophy would never embrace that reality. And so it's queer. I think what queerness means for me is something that's simply covered over, that can't be seen by normative discourses that have power to control our society. Queerness is something that's always bubbling up, breaking open. And that's what Jesus did in his own society constantly, without betraying the created order or the law, which I think is the tension we're called to live in. So I'm passionate about a queerness that lives towards holiness rather than a queerness that lives towards destruction or the violence towards created structures.
So your existence as a gay celibate Oxford theologian isn't sad and gloomy? I'm pressing this a bit because, yeah, you know, I'm just conscious that there'll be some listeners who just, you know, oh, scratch beneath, he must be a tortured soul, really. That cheerful laugh that we hear, you know, it can't be real. Speak to that person.
I think there's a difference between grief and between sadness. For me, I'm definitely not a sad person. I'm very filled with joy, and I don't really believe in happiness. I really don't. In fact, I had a debate with a friend of mine who wrote a book about being happy in a kind of Christian way, and I can't stand it, the thesis. But I read it, and it's a very good book, but I just totally disagree that we're supposed to be happy. I believe we're meant to be joyful, and joyful comes through suffering and pain. I think what's different for me is that I don't believe in staying in grief. I believe we need to pass through grief into the good, you know, into, for me, it's expressing worship to God or living in the presence of God. So for me, I don't really feel like there's a part of me that's depressed or, but I do feel like I've gone through extreme grief in the last 3 years, especially in how the church has been dealing with sexuality and gender. I think that's been one of my biggest griefs, is just seeing how badly both ends of the spectrum are doing it and just constantly feeling like it's missing the mark. And it's like watching your family be incredibly dysfunctional, you know, and you just feel the pain of that. But when I'd actually go to me living as a celibate gay Christian before Jesus in the way that I've found it to be, that's not what generates most of my pain or grief at all, really. I think if I'm in a world where there's a pressure socially to cover up the space to be that, and yes, is a quite torturous thing, but that's not actually coming from the thing itself. They're outside pressures. And so I want to fight for the space for that to actually happen, you know, for future generations of people who say, I want to follow Jesus, I want to do that biblically, but not conservatively or liberally, but in this deeper way. I want that space to be there for them. And so some of the pain I go through, I think, is a sacrifice for a future generation of Christian, and actually a kind of Christian that's always existed throughout the church, but maybe could never articulate their existence before because of the same political realities.
Finally, for the listener to this conversation who doesn't know the love of God, what do you mean? What is so special about God's love?
I think the love of God is what we are fashioned for. So when you find the love of God, it's like you've discovered the thing you were made for. So everything else exists in and around it. If you try to enjoy any part of the world and its good in and of itself, it ends up becoming a hell, because you worship it and then it becomes an idol and then it breaks apart. And we see this in modern reality all the time. Celebrity culture, it's in the church, celebrity culture, you know. That's all trying to fight for the good in creation and enjoy it in and of itself, and then it breaks, because that's not what it's made for. But the love of God is the thing at the center that you need to enjoy everything through. It releases everything in the world to be what it truly is. And so Jesus on the cross lays down his life for us, showing us what love is. And he says the greatest love you can have is not marriage or sex, but to lay down your life for your friend. And really, he's the only human in existence who could do that perfectly and purely, because he wasn't threatened by that same disorder. He could really lay that life down. And then that love, that first act of complete self-giving, sets off a chain reaction through the world that releases us from our fallenness, our idolatry, our brokenness of fighting power, domination over each other. And the love of God just transforms everything, you know. So for me, it's in that act of Jesus laying down his life on the cross, we see the explosion of life into the resurrection. And that's what the love of God is. It's that expression and revelation of who God really is as this perfect friend who really does love you with everything. And you can't find that in any human being on earth. Every human being's love will always be compromised on some level. They can't provide that. Only God can provide that. So to me, that's why the love of God is so amazing. There is nothing else like it. And it's kind of ineffably good. And it is the center of everything we're supposed to be as humans. And I think without it, we can't be truly human.
An Undeceptions podcast.